Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington, D.C.
And how do we ensure and how do we make sure that the voices of persons with disabilities is heard across the political process when it comes to election? How do we make sure not only voting is accessible, but also people with disabilities are able to politically participate, run for political office, their voices are heard across the board?
Sarah Minkara, President Joe Biden's special advisor on international disability rights, plans to visit Nigeria next week.
We continue to pursue these approaches, both in South Sudan, in DRC, and in Somalia, in the hope that we will be able to bring peace in this region.
Uganda's foreign minister says the East African country is working with its neighbors to end conflict to ensure peace and stability in the region.
To have value addition to our raw materials, that is what our president championed. And one is the formation of the Ghana Integrated Aluminium Development Corporation and that of Ghana Integrated Iron Steel Development Corporation.
And George Duka, the Ghanaian Deputy Minister for Lands and Natural Resources, says the government is implementing new measures to combat illegal gold mining. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Sarah Minkara, President Joe Biden's special advisor on international disability rights, says her blindness has become a big part of who she is. She says it's shaped her purpose, her career, and her path, and how she sees the world. She is internationally recognized as an advocate for leadership, empowerment, disability inclusion, and social enterprise. Minkara's remark comes as she plans a visit to Nigeria ahead of the West African country's general election next year. Voters will go to the polls on February 25th to choose a new president and other national, state, and local officials. For more on her planned trip, I reached Biden's special advisor, Sarah Minkara, via Microsoft Teams in part one of the interview. She began by talking about her background.
So a little bit about my background. I am a woman. I'm a person with a disability. I'm an entrepreneur. I come from the nonprofit world as well. I grew up in the U.S. I was born in the D.C. area, grew up in Boston. I became blind at age 7. And to be honest, that moment of losing my sight was a big part of kind of what shaped my future. But because I had empowering parents and a support system, both my sister and I, who's also blind, we lived a full life because we were seen, we were heard, we were valued, and we were empowered to really tap into our potential, our value, and our dreams. And we lived a full life, and I was able to continue going to the public school system. I went to college, majored in math and economics. I went to grad school. I traveled the world, and you know, I was able to hike and slide down a volcano in Nicaragua. But again, that's not because I have more value or more potential, but because I had the privilege of being seen, heard, and valued. And I think this goes back to what led me to starting my first nonprofit organization, then my company that really revolves around this whole concept of how to really see people with disabilities through the lens of value. How do we make sure they are integrated, they're included, not because it's just the right thing to do, but it brings value to society. And that's what brought me into this role as special advisor on international disability rights. How do we advance the rights of persons with disability through the lens of value? How do we make sure society at large really believes and brings forward this concept that when we include people with disabilities, it brings value to everyone?
Now, Special Advisor Minkara, I understand you are planning to go to Nigeria. So let me ask you, Nigeria heads to the polls in February next year. For persons with disabilities, what are your thoughts about inclusion in the election process?
That's a really good question. So we're headed to Nigeria next week. It's going to be actually my first official trip to Africa. And the reason why we chose Nigeria is for many different reasons. But one of them, as you mentioned, is there's the upcoming elections in February. And how do we ensure and how do we make sure that the voices of persons with disabilities is heard across the political process when it comes to election? How do we make sure not only voting is accessible, but also people with disabilities are able to politically participate, run for political office, their voices are heard across the board? So that is a big part of why our trip, we set forward our first country trip to Africa to be Nigeria. And beyond that as well, Nigeria is the largest economy in the African continent. So there's so much power in terms of us really having this conversation around promoting disability inclusive democracy. And there's really great organizations like IFA, Inclusive Friends Association, that focuses on the inclusivity of persons with disabilities in the political process in Nigeria. So we want to kind of continue supporting that effort and other efforts when it comes to disability inclusive democracy.
Well, talk to me about the importance of creating economic opportunities for persons with disabilities in Nigeria, especially when you noted that Nigeria, as is widely known, has the largest economy on the continent.
I mean, it goes back to, you know, it's estimated that 1/7 of our populations are persons with disabilities. So globally, that's 1 billion. That's 15% of our population. That translates into every single country in many ways. It's estimated between 15 to 20%. Now, if we as an economy are not including people with disabilities into our economy, we're losing out. And it's estimated that up to 7% of our GDP is impacted when we don't include persons with disabilities into our economy. 7%. And to be honest, I believe it's a bit more. So when we talk about, you know, including people with disabilities into our economy, it's not only inclusive employment, making sure companies are including and hiring persons with disabilities. It's also about how to really make sure we're creating a culture where persons with disabilities are seen through a value-based lens, are seen as people that can contribute, are seen as people that can bring forward innovation, are seen as people that can contribute into in the entrepreneurship world and to our economy. That is what we need to do. So we need to really structure our perspective when we're talking about economic development to make sure we're including persons with disabilities.
Sarah Minkara is President Joe Biden's Special Advisor on International Disability Rights. She spoke with me via Teams from here in Washington, D.C. A newly released poll shows Peter Obi, presidential candidate for the opposition Labour Congress, will win Nigeria's upcoming February presidential election. Carried out by Bloomberg News, the poll shows 72% of respondents say they plan to vote for Obi. It also shows that the presidential vote will be a three-person race. It expects former Governor of Lagos State Asiwaju Ahmed Bola Tinubu from the ruling All Progressive Congress, or APC, and former Vice President Atiku Abubakar to be competitive in parts of the country. But supporters of the two leading parties dismiss the findings, saying they have the nationwide structures to win the presidential vote. They contend that Obi only has the support of young people who make noise on social media but are unreliable voters. For more analysis about the poll and latest political development, I reach attorney Adefila Kamal. He is the president of the Network for Good Governance, a non-partisan umbrella group of civil society groups in Nigeria.
One thing I can see for certain is that Peter Obi is pulling more weight than everyone would have expected. And of course, it's like a revolution that is likely going to happen. He's not someone that can be underrated in the current political space of the country. But nevertheless, we must also put into cognizance the fact that most of the electorate are people that most likely don't even have access to the internet. For example, in Kano State, I can tell you for a fact that we have the issue of underage voting and all of that. And most of them, apart from radio, which is their major source of communication, most of these people really cannot be sampled. And that is, those are the kind of places where the results come out in mass and all of that. But on the general outlook, Peter Obi is becoming a threat to both of the two political gladiators.
Why do you think Peter Obi is generating a lot of popular support across Nigeria?
The issues are not far-fetched. One is that an average Nigerian is tired of the way the country is currently being governed. And for example, we all know about the economic hardship, the devaluing of the naira, and the fact that inflation is rising at about 25%, currently. And secondly, and more importantly, the security situation of the country. The present government has not been able to really put in any meaningful result or action towards making sure that the security challenge of the country is a thing of the past. An average Nigeria is really not concerned. So there is this inner agitation. You can see that the United Kingdom have said that they've issued about 85% new visas to Nigerians, with far more than what they have ever issued in the past. So an average Nigerian that has the means are even ready to leave the country, both to UK, US, and anywhere. So the issues are just glaring. It's looking at us. There is the food inflation, rising unemployment, and all of that. And there's also the issue of underemployment in the country. So we can't look away from that.
Some people are saying that Peter Obi is only generating a lot of traction on social media, and that perhaps his supporters might not have the PVC or might not even have registered to vote, and that the two leading political parties could win. They put first at Asiwaju Bola Ahmed Tinubu due to the political advantage of the ruling party using the power of incumbency, and Atiku Abubakar, who has the name recognition and who has run successive presidential election as a contestant. What is your take?
I think that any politician at this moment that try to underrate the chances of Peter Obi will be doing so at his or her own peril. The truth of the matter is that Peter Obi has held nothing less than the Peter Obi team has held nothing less than 5 to 6 rallies in the country, both in the middle belt or the north central and the south. And all of those rallies have been well attended. You know, they were all well attended. And that tells you something, that those supporting Peter Obi are people that are not afraid. And they are doing this, most of the finances are out of pocket finances. That means that nobody is motivating them. It is just what they feel they should do. And the truth is that with the signing of the Electoral Act, that is one of the kudos we must give to this government. It will be very, very hard for anybody to read. So the power of incumbency, I don't think anybody can read where they are not popular. That is just the truth with the signing of the new Electoral Act. And then when you look at the social media itself, you will see that most of the hits that both the PDP and the APC have been giving, as they've stopped concentrating on each other. You know, one would have expected that APC will concentrate on eating at the PDP, PDP will concentrate on eating at APC. But most the two camps are now eating at Peter Obi. APC is eating at the Peter Obi camp. The data boys of PDP are also eating at Peter Obi camp. So that tells you that something is happening. And let me tell you something. The Peter Obi team has people all over the country. There are the moderates. More importantly, people that have been on strike, all these students that have been on strike for 7 months. And they believe, whether right or wrong, that it is because this present government has not done enough.
Attorney Adefila Kamal is the president of the Network for Good Governance, a nonpartisan umbrella group of civil society groups in Nigeria. He spoke with me from the capital, Abuja. Uganda's foreign minister says the East African country is committed to working with its neighbors to end conflict to ensure peace and stability in the region. General J.J. Odongo, who is currently in Washington for bilateral meetings with officials of the U.S. government, says Uganda houses the largest refugee settlement in the region. His remarks come as Uganda marks 60 years of bilateral relations between the government in Kampala and Washington. The foreign minister also denied accusations that the government uses the COVID-19 pandemic to suppress dissent and free speech. In part one of this Skype interview, General J.J. Odongo tells me why the administration in Kampala is committed to ensuring peace and stability in East Africa and the rest of Africa.
It is true for us in Uganda, we attach a lot of importance to peace and security and stability for the simple reason that many activities are impossible to undertake if there is no peace and security. And so we attach a lot of importance to this. the pain and suffering caused by war, resulting in immigration, disaster movement, disaster for refugees, are things that we take in very, very seriously, and we feel so emotional sometimes about them. This is why we take a lot of care to ensure that we get involved in activities that will engender peace and security in the region. Obviously, we cannot be able to do it alone, so we must be able to collaborate with our colleagues, with our neighbors, in a collective effort to bring about the desired results of peace and security in the region. We continue to pursue these approaches, both in South Sudan, in DRC, and in Somalia, in the hope that we will be able to bring peace in this region. We've been able to demonstrate that this approach is successful, and we'd like to pursue it, and hopefully we will be able to get support from others in the regional efforts that we're involved in.
Now, talking about peace and security, you just mentioned the refugee situation in that part of East Africa. What is the current situation there, and how is Uganda helping to give some form of solace to those refugees seeking shelter and running away from conflict in their respective countries?
You know, at this material time as we speak, Uganda is hosting 1.5 million refugees coming from South Sudan, coming from the Democratic Republic of Congo, as well as from Burundi. Our approach to refugee handling is an open-door policy, because we understand the pain and indignity that relocating, dislocation brings about. Peter, you know, for an African, being able to fend for your family gives you pride as a person. Dislocation sometimes takes that away from you, and you live in a sense of indignity. And so our policy is geared towards restituting dignity in the person. That's why we maintain an open-door policy. That's why we have settlements rather than refugee camps. Refugees in Uganda can work, go to school, can be able to access the services that citizens in Uganda are able to access. We provide our refugees in the settlements with land so that the men, the families, can be able to fend themselves and once again have a life of dignity.
Well, Mr. Foreign Minister, you are here in Washington. I'm sure you are having a lot of bilateral meetings with officials here in Washington. Well, you are also aware that the White House will be organizing the U.S.-Africa Summit, in December. What are your expectations, the bilateral relations between Kampala and Washington, and your expectations of the upcoming summit?
This year, we're celebrating 60 years of bilateral relations and diplomatic relations with the United States of America. This, by no means, is no mean achievement. My coming here, first and foremost, is to look at how we can deepen that historical relations that we have, what other ways and means are available for us to deepen, and what new areas of cooperation we can be able to explore together. Obviously, it is interesting that towards the end of this year, we'll have the U.S.-Africa Summit. We are looking at that summit being able to open for us new avenues to do business. We are looking at that summit being able to establish for Africa a new understanding on ways in which we can carry forward our relations with the United States. Relations of partnership, sovereignty, and relations of mutual respect.
General J.J. Odongo is Uganda's foreign minister. He spoke with me from here in Washington. George
George Mrekuduka, the Ghanaian Deputy Minister for Lands and Natural Resources, says the government is implementing new measures to combat illegal gold mining. The move, he says, forms part of the effort to prevent the destruction of water bodies and the environment caused by the activity. His remarks come after a public outcry over concerns that illegal mining, a local Ghanaian term also called galamsey, is destroying water bodies in several parts of the country. Several foreigners, including Chinese nationals, have been arrested for allegedly committing crimes. Officials of the government, Duka says, are also worried about the effect illegal mining is having on the destruction of the environment and water bodies. In a Skype interview on the sidelines of the just-concluded UN General Assembly in New York, Deputy Lands and Natural Resources Minister talks to me about the efforts the administration is implementing to resolve the challenges facing the country due to illegal mining.
Let me say that, yes, indeed, Ghanaians are expressing concerns about how illegal mining is consuming part of our mining regions. And it's also a concern to His Excellency, the President of the Republic. And there are a gamut of measures we've put in place to ensure that we clamp down recalcitrants who have taken it upon themselves to destroy our river bodies and that of our forest zones. These measures, I must say, have gone a long way in making sure that we regularize the small-scale mining sector.
As the deputy minister in charge of handling this issue, specifically, what are you doing to regularize the small-scale mining sector?
It is important for us as a ministry, and for that matter, as a deputy minister responsible for mining, to ensure that we leave a legacy that Ghanaians will be proud of, in terms of regularizing the small-scale mining sector. And these are some of the measures we've put in place, making sure that we move all the illegal miners from where they are to a regularized section. And that is what we have termed as community mining. So we have a database from the Minerals Commission, and that database is worked in collaboration with Ghana Geological Survey Authority. So they determine where a mineralized area. Then government supports this mineralized area with mining equipment. We get mining engineers from University of Mines and Technology, geologists, minerals engineers to assist that concession. The idea is to, in a way, have a kind of equally important earning in terms of wages for these miners. Because if you're talking of alternative livelihood, then you don't provide something that they would appreciate. Take my word, they will come back. Another aspect that we also doing as a government is to also make sure that we get our river bodies protected. So just recently, we procured speedboats for the Naval Command, for them to be patrolling the banks of our river bodies 24/7, just to secure the integrity of our river bodies. Two, another aspect that we also seriously making sure that we do as a government is to have a kind of river guards who augment the strength of the Ghana Navy.
Looking at the mining sector, talk to me about prospects for the future in terms of value addition. Because for a long time, a lot of people are saying it's just the raw materials, it's just the gold, sometimes it's not refined, sent abroad, and all those kinds of issues. Ghana's minerals, are there any specific measures for value addition that will earn the country more money or foreign exchange?
That is what we've been touting all this while, that it is important as a state to have value addition to our raw materials. That is what our president championed. And one is the formation of the Ghana Integrated Aluminium Development Corporation and that of Ghana Integrated Iron Steel Development Corporation. These are two thematic pillars that we've set up as a government in the area of value addition. The GIADEC that I mentioned, the Ghana Integrated Aluminium Development Corporation, is to ensure value addition in the bauxite value chain that previously or even now, we get the bauxite exported in a raw form, then tend to import alumina to produce aluminium. And alumina is very expensive. So why don't you produce the bauxite in a raw form, then turn it to alumina locally, and then manufacture your aluminium? And that is what we're working on. And that is why we have a corporation that has been dedicated to ensure that we finalize on that, and that we're working hard on that. And with the iron and steel industry, we're using the same formula as the Kia deck to have the KISS deck, so that we can, at the end of the day, manufacture our own steel locally.
George Mreku Duka is the Ghanaian Deputy Minister for Lands and Natural Resources. He spoke with me from New York. Burkina Faso's Army Captain Ibrahim Traoré announced Friday evening that the army has seized power and ousted military leader Paul-Henri Damiba, who himself had taken power in a coup only 8 months ago. Traoré said in a statement that a group of officers who helped Damiba seize power in January had decided that the leader was no longer able to secure the country, which has been battling a mounting Islamic insurgency. The statement signed by Traoré was read on state television late Friday by another military officer. For analysis and the latest political development, I reach Paul Ijeme. He is a global affairs analyst, a former war correspondent, and an independent consultant on corporate strategic communication, media, peace and security, and elections.
It's not entirely unexpected, because the military, when they took over in January of this year, the reason given was that they were going to fight this Islamic extremist that are linked to Al-Qaeda and then ISIS. But in the last couple of months, Burkina Faso has seen four deadly attacks, killing of soldiers and also civilians. So it then means that they have not lived up to the ability, because Damiba and his group, they have literally sacked President Christian Roch Kabore, saying that he was incapable of dealing with the situation. But they too have shown that they are not up to the task, even with the support from France.
But Paul, ECOWAS has come out to condemn the coup. Some people say that this coup also sets back the transitional process to constitutional rule, which ECOWAS accepted to be a two-year process. Some people say ECOWAS appears to be weak in spite of the fact that it has a policy against the forceful overthrow of a legitimate government. Do you think the criticisms against ECOWAS are justified?
Yes, and that is what many people are saying, that ECOWAS should not put itself in that situation. This is the same organization that has been able to settle ended wars in Liberia and Sierra Leone and all that, and has been able to settle conflict across some of its 15 member states, but it now appears suffering from executive incapacity. There is deficiency, let's say so. Deficit of leadership, both at the national and regional level, because you cannot give what you don't have. If you gather 15 heads of state, that among them, you cannot find anybody who has managed to deliver the book. You don't expect them, whether they are now working as a collective, to do that. And part of the problem is that they tend to be protecting themselves. Some of them are tampering with their national constitution for tenure in administration, and then which is against the ECOWAS protocol. But that aspect is not being addressed.
Where do you think
the people of Burkina Faso or the Burkinabes go from here? Do you anticipate them embracing this latest coup?
Well, of course, that's what usually what happens. We saw some of them on the streets jubilating. But very soon, it will change because they will soon realize that if the honeymoon will end as soon as they realize that coup leaders are not up to it. What the people need is not good governance.
Paul Ijeme is a global affairs analyst, a former war correspondent, and an independent consultant on corporate strategic communication, media, peace and security, and elections. He spoke with me from Nigeria's capital, Abuja. You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, financial experts are calling on governments to partner with the private sector in order to include their citizens in the formal banking sector. This, they argue, could also help the administrations compile data and generate revenue. Leading the effort is Finclusion Group, a South African-based company operating in South Africa, Kenya, Tanzania, Eswatini, and Namibia, with plans to soon expand to Uganda and Mozambique. Officials say the group seeks to enhance financial inclusion in Africa with data-driven lending. They also say the organization focuses on creating value for employees, business owners, and consumers while closing the credit gap in Africa. For more on how financial inclusivity will pivot the unbanked from the informal marketplace to the formal marketplace, I reach Timothy Nui. He is the co-founder and co-chief executive officer of the Finclusion Group.
Digital financial services are a first step from informal to formal, because even if something is not governed by, per se, an employment contract or similar, if there is a digital footprint of transactions, then one can effectively start using those transactions to build lending and other decisions off. So in our credit scoring, we use mobile money transactions. And someone with a mobile wallet, they may not be formally banked, they may not have access to lending products, but they can start to get access because there is actual data available on them. We can actually build, you know, a historic income and expense statement, and we can start seeing what their financial services are doing, what they should be using, what they could be using, what they would qualify for. And I think that's why it's so important to move from what's, you know, not traceable, as in cash and completely off the radar, to traceable transactions on the back of which we can grant financial services. So I think that's where, you know, financial inclusion is so important and uplifting, because we need that first step of digital payments to then move forward with credit and other services.
Tim, what is meaningful financial inclusivity in Africa, its importance and its impact?
So what to me is quite critical is to not just actually be, you know, counting statistics and basically adding, you know, bank accounts or payment accounts, but having financial services that customers use and that drive value. So ensuring that not only do they have an account, but they have an account they can use and it'll actually help them get better service than they could otherwise get. For us, the way we look at this conclusion, it's predominantly in saying, how do we get people access to credit? And the types of credit that's not mini nano loans, but sort of more substantial loans over a longer period, they can use to do meaningful things, whether improving a home, sending kids to school, or starting a business. The importance of it is that through that financial inclusivity with access to credit, one can drive economic productivity and really add to the, you know, economic prowess of the emerging middle class as and when they grow, because without access to capital, many of them wouldn't be able to do that. And then I think the financial infrastructure that gets created through that, the further data that one collects, over time, people are able to uplift themselves, because an emergency loan can lead to an installment loan could lead to a mortgage or a business loan, and effectively it becomes a sort of, you know, perpetuum mobile, where automatically it's a vicious circle where things continuously, you know, start improving for that person. But you need that kick trigger to actually start off that process, and I think that's what financial inclusion and digital financial services can achieve.
So how can the private sector, Tim, integrate country-born country in Africa with varying bureaucratic restrictions?
So I think it's a very good question. It's not easy always. I think one of the big challenges we face is that every market in Africa is standalone and is different, right? So, you know, in as much as the EU has licensed passporting, the US, you can operate across different states. In Africa, every country has to start from scratch and follow all the red tape. But I think private capital is absolutely critical. They can contribute by basically, you know, being available. And I think where there's an opportunity for people to participate is through embedded credit, because effectively embedded credit does allow for a win-win situation in the sense that products and services that are oftentimes developed or provided by the Western world can then be acquired through deferred terms and credit in inclusive solutions. So I think that's where, you know, a very natural win-win comes in, where both financial upside for the Western world is there, but it's provided to the bottom of the pyramid at, you know, more attractive terms they could otherwise afford, if that makes sense. And otherwise, it's really just continuous debt capital. I think if I go back sort of 10, 20 years, a lot of development financial institution capital went towards microfinance institutions to make a real impact. One of the difficulties, I think, on the continent is that a lot of those MFIs, they haven't scaled the way they maybe should have scaled, and the capital requirements they have today are still small. So what we see is that some of the big organizations like the IFC, like the CDC, FMO, they have in fact scaled and now are of such a size that their facilities they'd like to provide to Africa are so big that they end up going to the tier one banks and ending up underpinning some of the sort of blue chip development in those markets. But what we need is more capital to also be available for those MFIs that are actually addressing that bottom of the pyramid, MSME, and, you know, smaller sized markets. So I think that's where a real gap exists, is how to effectively create an effective pipeline of capital from the West to Africa for those type of products.
Timothy Nui is the co-founder and co-chief executive officer of the Finclusion Group. He spoke with me from Johannesburg, South Africa. In Zambia, a leading anti-corruption campaigner is calling on President Hakainde Hichilema to keep an eye on his appointees to ensure they don't engage in acts of corruption. Gregory Chifiri, director of the Southern African Network Against Corruption, also says the president must keep his promise to weed out corruption in all public institutions to ensure transparency and accountability. His remarks follow local media reports that some appointees are engaging in acts of graft, but supporters of the administration dismiss the report as an attempt by the opposition to demonize the government and reduce the president's popular support. For more on the calls on the president to ensure successful prosecutions of corruption and graft, I reach Gregory Chifiri.
Yes, of course. There are a few of the people that he works with that are engaged in dishonest activities. They are really trying, they'll try, like they'll spoil the broth for everyone. And they are going around, of course, getting bribes from business houses, promising them protection, so on and so forth. And there, of course, even where he works, at the state house, there are others using state protocols that are actually dictating what the president should see, what the president should hear. This is a very worrying trend that the president needs to open his eyes. This president came in at one of the promises to fight graft. He doesn't tolerate corruption.
But Gregory, do you have proof of these allegations that you are making? Because you are not mentioning any names. All you keep saying is that some people, who are those people? And why are you not presenting this evidence to the office of the president to deal decisively with it if you have that evidence?
Of course, I can't mention them on air, but the evidence is there. And of course, it's also common knowledge of some of them that are publicly known, but people are scared to speak and to say. If I had a chance, of course, to meet with the president, I definitely would. But of course, I'd give him pointers, because he has the machinery as a president to find out who or how some of his people are conducting themselves. There may be a few now, but you know, Zambians hate vices of graft. It's important that he weeds it out.
Well, Gregory, every Tom, Dick, and Harry cannot necessarily get up and say, I want to meet the president. The man is busy working and trying to keep his promises to improve the lives of the people of Zambia. So anybody at all cannot just get up and say they want to meet the president and is allowed to do so.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's my point. You see, this call comes on the background that we've seen in previous presidents how that they have been shielded from reality and from the truth. This president is a president that many Zambians worked for. It's a project that majority of Zambians worked for because we saw in him that is different from others. Now, our fear is that if he's captured by a certain group, a certain clique of individuals, some of the promises that he promised to work for the people will not be achieved. So what we are saying, or what we are crying about, is that the president should widen the scope of getting information, not only from those that are close to him, but he should create a mechanism where he meets even the nobodies like me, the nobodies in the slums. And the president has got that the leverage to do that. He's got powers to do that. If he wants to see the peasant in the village, he can simply call. So what I'm saying is that he should run away from the traditional ways of getting information and let him get information from even the ordinary. The world is changing now.
Some people are saying that the call you are making is a side attraction. Mm. It has no substance. And that is a distraction in itself to the government trying to work for the people of Zambia. And that what you are doing is just a publicity stunt just to draw attention to yourself and your organization just to feel relevant. Your response to that?
I've got no reason to distract the government whose intentions I support. And I've no reason to draw attention from anybody or any quota of society. I would speak the truth and sound a warning. If those that feel they want to listen, they should listen. If they feel it's irrelevant, so be it. But time will tell. Remember, when the PF government came into office, I think I was one of the first that pointed out that these guys are corrupt. But what happened? We created a monster of a political party. God forbid that we should do this with this new government.
Gregory Chifire is director of the Southern African Network Against Corruption. He spoke with me from the Zambian capital, Lusaka. Botswana Independence Day was marked by celebrations at the National Stadium in Habaroni, where President Mokgweetsi Masisi was in attendance. In his Independence Day message, he said the country is set for recovery. He says the war in Ukraine has exacerbated challenges, leaving local citizens with a heavy burden. But he says with the COVID-19 showing signs of abating, there's hope for revival. This week, Botswana lifted almost COVID-19 restrictions, including for visitors. Habaroni resident Mpo Kelefili says he is happy with the progress the country has made since independence in 1966. For VOA, Nkodisi Dube has the details from the Botswana capital, Habaroni.
Botswana Independence Day was marked by celebrations at the National Stadium in Habaroni, where President Mokgweetsi Masisi was in attendance. In his Independence Day message, he said the country is set for recovery. He says the war in Ukraine has exacerbated challenges, leaving local citizens with a heavy burden. But he says with the COVID-19 showing signs of abating, there is hope for revival. This week, Botswana lifted most COVID-19 restrictions, including for visitors. Habaroni resident Mpo Kelefile says he's happy with the progress the country has made since independence in 1966.
Our country has done a lot, even with COVID-19. Botswana is one of Africa's highest vaccination rates. We look at other African countries and we feel that leadership has done well since independence.
Germany's Ambassador Margit Helwig-Boyd is one of the many envoys who paid tribute to Botswana.
Botswana and Germany share the same values on democracy. We believe in human rights, and we believe in the necessity of the fight against climate change. And we also think that we have to secure peace and security in our respective areas. Coincidentally, Germany and Botswana celebrate their national days around the same time of the year.
Habron-based political analyst Waitsi Khosi says other African countries have a lot to learn from Botswana.
Quite impressive. Look at where Botswana has come from. Since independence, one can say it has been one of Africa's success stories. We come from afar, and other nations can learn from this. Botswana is there and enjoys relative success, both economically and politically. We have done extremely, extremely well.
From one of the poorest countries at independence, Botswana, a sparsely populated country of about 2 million people, is a successful multi-party democracy with elections every 5 years. It's also now an upper middle-income country, thanks largely to good governance and prudent economic management, including the use of revenues from diamonds, cattle, and tourism. The World Bank says with the warning of the COVID epidemic, the economy grew by 12% in 2021 and is expected to grow at about 4% this year. Living conditions have also improved. The bank says 20 years ago, close to 30% of the population lived on less than $1.90 per day. By 2015, it had declined to 16% and continues to improve today. For VOA, this is Mkondisi Dube in Habaroni, Botswana.
Right now it's time for music from our African collection.
Zekina. Awe. Batu Obombi. Cliff André, ça le motivateur des motivés. Ngambo. Yomo toi mon pronom. Siamo comme la copa. Ah yo boy comme la mou, est-ce que vous dites? Maître Didier Mindenge, maître Yonji Darcel, Stevie Cheba, c'est la rébellion lundi.
That was music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of The Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, including producer Nadia Taha, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, the disobedient fowl obeys in a pot of soup. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Good evening, Africa. Go solo.